Thank you, Jen. Thank you very much. It is so good to be here in Southern Illinois. How many of you drove here like I did? Yeah, I'm glad I got gas at a couple of key places because there's a long way between towns sometimes. You know, the first time I was ever in Southern Illinois, I think Mike Crawford invited me over to a place called Normal, Illinois. But I was coming from Indianapolis, and if you come that way, there's a little town called Oblong. And when I got to Normal, somebody actually told me that there was a newspaper headline that said, "Normal man marries oblong woman." I would love to have seen that, wouldn't you? But I got to tell you, Southern Illinois, it still can't compare to Northern Michigan. It is exactly, it's very similar. Last summer, I was driving across central Michigan, and it's pretty rural in that area, and I came to this, literally this community that was a crossroads. There was a blinking light, and there was a party store on one side, and there was a big billboard, a giant billboard for this little crossroads, and this is what it said. This is what you could get inside the store: beer, bait, booze, and bullets. And right across the street was Brooks United Methodist Church. So apparently you had to have a B to get on that corner. I don't know. Well, just before I jump into and what I wanted to share with you today, and honestly, I didn't know what to share with you. So I'm just going to share a little bit of my DNA, and not just mine, but I mean what I think works in any church of any size. And before I do that, I think it's important to thank a couple of people. My mom was always big on writing thank you notes. And she made us do that all the time, and I'm glad she did. It's a good habit. So if you don't mind, just for a second, I'm going to catch up on a couple of thank you notes. Is that okay? It's very important to do. Thank you, Christ Church Hospitality team, for all of your candy. It now resides on all of our waste lines. Thank you, Shane Bishop, for the 1 o'clock time slot. After lunch, I have to resort to thank you notes just to keep them awake. Thank you, Chick-fil-A, for making a little space between me and John Acuff and Telly Gadsden. Hard to follow. Thank you, Twitter, for allowing me only 140 characters every time I go to make a point. Thank you, Josh. He learned the music this morning. I got it from my music director about 10:30 last night. So, and just to introduce myself, I got a chance to plant a church in 1990, and I've been there ever since. So I'm almost a year 27. And it was really funny. The other day, Jim Griffith was in my church holding a seminar for people in our conference that are moving. You know, Jim, he always comes up with a new seminar that what people need, and we hire him to do it, and Jim was there doing transitions. What do you do when you say goodbye, and what do you do when you start your new church? And I just walked into the middle of it, and I said, really, this seminar is, you don't really need it if you just stay. And Jim said, get out and don't ruin my business. So, anyway, you know, people always want to know, what's the secret for staying a long time in a church? And how do you get to do that? You know, I think we've had five bishops in Michigan since I started the church. And I always just tell them, the only way you can do it is just keep the debt really high and then nobody else wants to come there. But that's not a real answer. But it was really awesome to be able to plant a church. And it was a great thing. I found some fat people, faithful, available, and teachable. And I always love that acronym because those are the kind of folks you want to help you start something new. And even whatever situation you're in right now, when you start something new that's a pioneer work, you want some faithful, available, and teachable people. I coined a phrase, I grabbed it from Ken Wierlein in Houston. He said, when you plant a church, some people are going to be pencil people, some people are going to be pen people, and some people are going to sign in blood. And that was so true. The pencil people will leave in about 3 months. And the pen people will hang around about 5 years, or a little bit more maybe. But the blood people are still with you. And I look out over my church now and I see a whole bunch of blood folks who have been there for 27 years, faithfully serving, giving. I mean, it's awesome to be with people like that. It's a great thing, great, great privilege to be able to do it. Anyway, Cornerstone has grown. We're in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It says Caledonia. You don't know where that's at, but it's a suburb of Grand Rapids. We average about 2,500 people, about 1,600 members. And I think if that ever turns around where we get more members than average attendance, I just want to quit. I just want to go the other direction. Because I think it's healthy to have more people coming than actually go through a membership process. I have an incredible wife, Colleen, and as was mentioned, two really beautiful kids that are grown up. Our kids are from Korea, and Colleen and I always thought we would be missionaries. We really had our goal set on Global Ministries or some other mission organization, and then we couldn't have children, and so we got into an adoption process, and you can't leave town once that starts. You have to stay there, and so we figured out our missionary experience was going to be planting a church instead, and that was really probably always part of God's plan, so it was really kind of a cool thing. So I've just put together just a list of seven things. Yeah, you ready? Okay. Here's a little introduction to Cornerstone. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Anyway, what I want to share with you is really not about Cornerstone. It is about some things I've learned over the years, but again, whether you're in a church of, none of you are in a church of 50, but it doesn't really matter, any size church. I think you can apply some of these things, and you've heard everything before. I sat through Matt's workshop, and Matt just shared 8 virtues of a growing church, and Matt and I are good friends, Matt Miosky, and I couldn't believe he shared 8, so I've just changed mine to 12, just because I want more than... No, really, I only have 7, and we have about 30 minutes, so let me just run through a couple of these things, and some of this is just our DNA. Number one is the mission has to be communicated over and over and over and over and over and over, as many times as you can say that. You can't stop talking about it, because I heard Ron Watts say yesterday, vision leaks, vision does leak, and also... not only does it leak, but you get new people all the time. And, you know, this came home to me just about 2 weeks ago. I'm sitting in a worship planning meeting. I have a tech guy in there who's given himself a title, the tech producer. He loves that title. So, but he's been there about maybe 3 years, and we were talking about some kind of direction for the worship planning, and he goes, well, really, what is the vision of Cornerstone? I went, wow. Oh my gosh, what's the vision of Cornerstone? And so what I'm working through with the staff is, what is our vision again? Let's just do it again. You know, you have to communicate mission over and over. Max Dupree once said, the leader's role is that you have to act like a third grade teacher repeating the vision over and over until people get it. You know, that is, that's incredibly true. You know, a lot of our mission has been based on the same thing as your mission. You all are familiar with Matthew 28, 19 and 20. You're also familiar with Luke 19:10, the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. But there are two verses that God shared with, spoke to my heart through beyond those sort of standard things for mission. One of them, this was in the early days of Cornerstone, came from Ephesians chapter 4. You know, in verses 7 through 10, there's this little weird section where the author quotes the Old Testament, and nobody's quite sure what it means. Maybe you are. I'm not quite sure what it means. But it spoke to me about what the church, and I don't think it's just my church, I think what the church ought to be. It says, what does it mean that he ascended? What does it mean? It also means that he descended. The author, I guess, is relating that to this Old Testament quote from the book of Psalms to Jesus. He also descended into the lower regions of the earth. And God just like, that's what your church needs to be about. You don't really need to reach people on the edge of heaven. You got to reach people on the edge of hell. That's what we're in business for, you know? I think so much church growth is just trading people around. And honestly, I have a giant church. We sold our old building to be the south campus of an 8,000-member church. And 2 miles from that, 2 miles away, is also another giant Wesleyan church. There's three of us like this. It's the Bermuda Triangle of transition, you know? And people are just on the move, it seems like, all the time. That doesn't really excite me. But people in the lower earthly regions, whatever that means, I know what it means for us. The other verse God just spoke to my heart about came about 15 or 20 years later as I got older. Did you notice how young I looked in those pictures? I had an awesome mullet, and I think it's coming back. I think it's coming back. It's going to return. But Psalm 71, verse 18. Psalm 71, verse 18. Even when I get to old age and gray hair, oh God, don't forsake me until I proclaim your truth to the next generation. Isn't that a great verse, Psalm 71, 18? I got to continue to reach the next generation, even at my age. You know, we can't stop. We can't go, well, we just really relate to people our own age. No, I've got to relate to the 20s and teenagers and millennials and everybody else. So I work really hard at that, and I'm not sure I accomplish it. But we have to keep aiming low all the time, lower in age, because we're all aging. So anyway, mission, you just repeat it over and over and over. When I started Cornerstone, I knew that I didn't want it to be a neighborhood church. I went to a Lyle Schaller seminar. Anybody ever been to one? Yeah, five of you. Okay. Lyle used to be pretty popular when he was doing workshops a lot. And I went to the seminar, and the title of it was How to Build a Regional Church. Because that's why I went, because I wanted to think about how do you build a regional church. And Lau was the first speaker, and he comes up to the microphone, and he's got kind of a gravelly voice, and he's wearing a t-shirt. And we didn't have iPads and laptops in those days. You know, we all had pens, and we're in notebooks. We're ready to write something down. He goes, so, you want to write something down? You want to know how to build a regional church? People have cars. There, write that down. He goes, that's all you need to know. People have cars. And in 1990, that was true. People will drive 20 miles if it meets the spiritual needs of my family. That's still true, but it's becoming less true. And we're finding in our Heritage Hill downtown campus that we're getting the majority of people, a lot of young families and a lot of millennials, because they can walk to church. There's this thing about walking places now, and I want a place in my neighborhood. So both are still true, but mission, helping people know Jesus and make him known, we just put it up on the back walls of our church in big giant letters, so every time somebody leaves, they can read it. That mission, to me, is indicated by this letter I just got a couple months ago. This is what a young guy who visited our church just for several months, and then he enlisted. Here's what he wrote. After high school, I struggled with drugs and addiction and depression. I found Cornerstone through a friend. I've been sober now for several months, and I wanted you to know that I joined the Army, and my goal is to be a Green Beret. But Cornerstone surrounded me with a positive message of Christ and gave me the strength to overcome my addiction. I will always remember your simple acts of kindness and acceptance. God has a purpose for me and for everyone. God sent me to Cornerstone, and God knew what I needed for my future. Home run for me. Home run. Lower earthly regions, whatever that means. The second thing on my list is worship. And here's how I'm going to say it. It has to speak, worship has to speak to this present age. This present age. The problem is, so many churches are dying, and worship is speaking to another generation, not this present age. I brought my laptop with me. You know what the sad thing is? Some of you in this room don't even know what this is. I barely remember it. You remember this thing? What's it called? Can you imagine giving this to a kid today? I can just imagine some of the questions. They go, how do I turn this thing off? You shake it. You pick it up and shake it, right? You know, how do I delete a document? You pick it up and shake it. Yeah, what if I want to reboot this thing? You pick it up and shake it. How do I delete something? You shake it. How do I save? Don't shake it. That's all you need to know, you know? It's a great metaphor because a lot of us are doing etch-a-sketch worship in an Apple generation. And we can't figure out why nobody's coming and why people aren't getting it. And why do we do it? Because we like it. And our people like it. And we're afraid to challenge them because some of them are the biggest givers. You know, it really struck me how different the generations are. I was out at my daughter has been married about 2.5 years, and she and Mitch, Kaylee and Mitch, live out in Madison, Wisconsin. Anybody here from Wisconsin? Yeah, great. Madison's a great town, and they love it there. But we were out there visiting them, and Mitch says, I'm going to grill some steaks and some pork chops or something. I think he had two different things. And so he goes out. We had bought him a grill for Christmas, and it's a big, nice big gas grill, and he flips it up, and, you know, I'm going to throw the stuff on. I'm going to help him. He's like, oh, no, wait. Let's Google how much time it's going to take for these 1-inch-and-a-quarter steaks. I'm like, you just eyeball this. No. You don't do that. He says it's going to take 6 minutes on one side, 7 on the other. But the pork chops were like stuffed and they were like really thick. And I'm like, maybe you want to put those on first, Mitch. Well, I better check it. So he's Google, grilling by Google now, you know. So you can't even grill on your own anymore. It's amazing the difference. And that's what we're up against. But, you know, we have hope because Charles Wesley, our guy, wrote A Charge to Keep I Have, right? Verse 2. To serve this present age. I don't think Charles Wesley would have said, let's just go back to the 1600s and do it that way. My calling to fulfill, oh, may it all my powers engage to do my master's will. I was in my office at the old 68th Street location one day on a Saturday morning. Nobody else was in the building, and the phone rings. And, you know, we preachers, we can't resist it. We think there might be a possible contact on the other side. So, phone rings, I pick up the phone. Some lady is just really ticked off, and she goes, what kind of a church is this? I want to know before I come. Well, there's a people-pleaser side of all of us, let's face it, you know, and I wanted to say, what kind of a church would you like? And I'll tell you what you want to hear, you know. It'll be whatever you are looking for. That's what I'm going to tell you. But I decided not to. I said, I'm just going to be honest with you. This is the kind of music you'd hear. And this is how you don't need to dress up. Or you can if you want. You don't have to. And we might do this. We might do that. And it was pretty casual. And suddenly her tone totally changed. And that edge wasn't in her voice anymore. She said, oh, I'm really glad to hear that. I'll be there tomorrow. I just want to be sure it wasn't one of those churches that you had to get all dressed up to take a nap. And I thought, wow, that's an indictment. Not against my church or your church, but all churches, isn't it? The perception was, and she was young, that I had to get dressed up, and it was going to be boring, and I'm going to go to sleep there. So worship has to be vital. It has to be alive. There has to be aggressive hospitality. You know, I was joking about the Christ team, but these guys are great at hospitality here. They model it really well. You got to do it week after week after week. I'm not kidding you. I was asked to coach a church in Missouri. I won't tell you which one. I'd like to tell you which one, but I won't. And they said, would you just sneak in and evaluate what's going on there in a worship experience? So I went to their early service. They had an early service. It was like 8:15 or 8:30. They said it's our traditional service. There's a lot of people there. Great. So I came in, did not have my pastor evaluator badge on or anything. There was a couple at the door. They had those doors, like, you know, the outside one, then the inside one, the little airlock thing, and they were in the airlock, and they were in their upper 80s, I'd say, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they were freezing. It was a chilly morning. I opened the door as a guest, the outside door, and the guy said, shut that door, it's cold. This was the greeter. It cracked me up, like, what? Shut that door. See, your hospitality has to be incredible these days. You know, I hear that over and over. You know, not only did you guys greet people when we came in, but the greeters also show up when you leave. And, you know, and they actually try to have conversations with you. And you got to try to remove the barriers, be it music. You know, it's not about your preference, really. It's not about the preference of the biggest givers. It's about what was going to reach your neighborhood, your mission field. What's going to appeal to them the most? That's the only business we're in, is to help people find Jesus, right? You know, if clothing is a barrier, you have to be careful how you say that. Get rid of it. I didn't ever really want to wear clergy clothes, so it was really nice to start your own church. You didn't have to. Pulpits, you know, all these kind of things that are barriers for people. Churchy language, non-applicational preaching. There's a great verse in the book of Acts 19:26, and it's said by Paul's enemies. I love this. And you see and hear how this fellow Paul has convinced and led astray large numbers of people in Ephesus and practically the whole of Asia. Wouldn't it be great to say about our preaching that we've led large numbers astray? I mean, I would love to have that said about me. They meant it like to really nail Paul, but it's important. I got an email, not an email, it was a Facebook message. I checked up on a guy. You know, Facebook is great for checking up on people. And you can do some pastoral care without driving all over town, you know. So there was a guy, I just hadn't seen him. I always say the Lord has given me spiritual peripheral vision, and I don't see everybody by any means, not in the 2,500 attending church. But every now and then, a picture of somebody will come to my mind. I think God, the Holy Spirit, does that. Somebody who's disappeared. So I sent this guy a message, and this is what he said. The reason I stopped coming to church is because it was becoming too real. I wasn't sure I wanted to open up to God that much. And I haven't been attending because I know I'll have to deal with some stuff on the inside if I do. I was sad on one hand, but I'm kind of happy on the other. That's the kind of church he found, that he had to deal with stuff. I love what Paul says in Romans, in the message, Romans 12, 1 and 2. So here's what I want you to do, God helping you. Take your everyday, ordinary life, your sleeping, eating, going to work, and walking around life, and place it before God as an offering. Embracing what God does for you is the best thing that you can do for him. Don't become so well adjusted to your culture that you fit into it without even thinking. Instead, fix your attention on God, and you'll be changed from the inside out. Isn't that a great paraphrase? Okay, so we're going to move really fast. So the third thing I want to share with you, the thing that has helped us grow over the years, besides repeating the mission over and over and trying to keep adjusting worship, and our worship style has changed. You saw my first one with that tie and the big pulpit and all that, you know. We've had to keep morphing. You got to keep changing to meet the culture. The third one is just groups. You grow larger by acting smaller. You grow larger by acting smaller. In my early days, I had a guy from the Boy Scouts, and he left our church and went on to Dallas to go to the national headquarters or something. He was telling me the story of this Cub Scout troop. It was a troop that most of the kids came from this one neighborhood, and it was by a school in this neighborhood, and the Cub Scout leader, or Boy Scout, I think it was Cub Scouts, took the kids out into the woods. It was right nearby. And he said to this one kid, "You stay right here. I'm going to take the rest of the troop over the hill. We're going to teach them first aid. We're going to rush back over the hill, and you're going to be the wounded guy. And we're going to patch up your leg, and it's going to be, you know, there's going to be a wound." The kid sits there. He goes over the hill. The scout leader gets so into his lesson, he kind of forgot about the kid back here who's wounded. So it's like so much time has passed. He grabs the troop. They rush back over the hill, and they find a note in the ground that said, "Have bled to death and gone home." You know, in our churches, people are bleeding to death and going home. They're leaving because they're not connected. And so you got to work really, really hard at groups and relational ministry. Everything we do, we try to think, how do we break this into groups? If it's Wednesday night teaching, how do we break people into groups and have them connect with each other? How do we do that over and over and over and over? Because it's so important. We started small groups, we were about 200, and I got to tell you this, and I can say this to you guys, because you are pastors and church leaders, it just stops a lot of whining. If you got groups, it stops a whole lot of whining. Because people whine when they're not cared about. And when they're in a group, somebody's going to care about them. Somebody will know if they're sick, somebody will know if they're in the hospital, somebody will know. Your church might grow, and you might not know, but that's all right. I love that verse in Acts 20:20. It's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. I think it's really cool that God put it in Acts 20:20. "You know that I have not hesitated to preach anything that would be helpful to you, and I taught you publicly and from house to house." It's God's 2020 vision for the church. There's public worship, and there's house to house. I love it that God just saw fit to put that in there, the 2020. Growth happens best in groups. When people can ask their questions and talk about what they're learning. And even if they have, I got a group now, I'm telling you, Colleen and I are in a group and everybody's a millennial but us. In fact, they even said that to us. They go, "We're all millennials, you're not." Like, "Oh, you invited us in." And we're having a blast with those guys. And they have gigantic doubts. And they're going through stuff like cancer and death of a loved one in their family. And we're studying James and they're going, "This is not joy." When we're going through trials, there's nothing joyful about it. Like, "What do you think, Brad?" You know, they're doing stuff like that. this is too funny. I got funny stories, but I got to keep going. Care happens best in groups. Growth happens best. Care happens best. Just last week, I'm not kidding you, there's a lady that's led groups in our church. She's been diagnosed now with lesion spots all through her body. Started in a melanoma on her back, and so she's in this little rehab center, and her friend who's in her small group sends me a message, "If you could just visit Carol, she would be greatly encouraged." And, you know, honestly, I don't do that much visiting. We have so many people that do visiting. We depend on small groups for visiting, you know. But I was on my way somewhere. I mean, I stopped there. I do visiting when I can. I stopped to see Carol. As soon as I walked in the room, she was just angry. "Well, nobody from the church has been here yet." That was their opening line. I go, "Carol, that can't be true. Judy told me she's been here every day. You've been in this rehab center." "Oh, yeah, Judy, yeah." And she goes, "And all the girls in my small group, they've been wonderful. They've been here every single day." I go, "Carol, hello." You know, hello. The care director at my church has a name tag that says "Nobody" because... She does. She's made her own name tag. Says "Nobody" because if she goes to visit somebody, it's like nobody was here because I wasn't there, you know. I said, "Carol, you know, you've been around Cornerstone. We've never hired a care pastor." "Oh, yeah, I guess we haven't." I said, "Yeah, we depend on small groups, don't we? That's our front line." And she goes, "Yeah, I guess that's right." She knew that, but nobody from the church had been there. Mission happens best in small groups when they do it together. Number four. Leadership is an important thing. You know, almost all of our churches have the same vision. And if you have adopted the United Methodist statement, we all pretty much on the same path. But a leader has to lead the vision. A leader has to actually lead. I'm not kidding you. True story. There's a young leader in our conference who did a great job. He went into a church of about 80. It went to almost 500 in about 5 years. And he moved on. They called him, had a different appointment, and he left. The guy that followed him, here was his opening line: "It's not my job to lead you. It's my job for you to determine what your vision is, and I'll get behind and push." And I thought, where in the Bible did a shepherd ever push the sheep? I'm trying to remember that. You know, what a dumb thing to say. But I think there's so many times when leaders just don't lead. Leadership is not easy. It's hard. Man, you're trying to cast vision. You're trying to determine the strategy. You're helping build teams. You're trying to move people by influence. You're trying not to turn off all the old guard. You're trying to bring them along. You know, all that is happening at the same kind of simultaneously. You're trying to gain respect. But leaders just have to be normal. Normal is really a good thing. Normal Illinois was probably named after just normal people. Leaders, here's just a quick list. Leaders think long term. I heard somebody say this yesterday. Leaders have to be thinking, I think Shane said this, 3 or 4, 5 years out ahead of everybody else. You have to think larger context. You have to push boundaries. It's not always safe. You got to take risks. The fastest growing churches take some risks. Sometimes they fail, but they try stuff. And if it doesn't work, they put it in the closet and it's okay. They tried it. Maybe God has something else. Leaders have to put emphasis on the intangibles. I love this one. You have to influence people. It's morale that you care about. It's motivation. It's momentum. It's emotions. It's attitudes. It's atmosphere. It's the timing. All those are intangibles. Leaders learn to rely on their intuition, and leaders invest in the power of others. They don't try to do it all themselves. Telly talked about that this morning. You got to let other people lead. And leaders see themselves as agents of change. But the last one is leaders are dependent on God, most of all. Most of all. I love this verse from Numbers 11. "Here I am," I think this is Moses talking, "among 600,000 men on foot, and you say, 'I will give them meat to eat for a whole month?'" Moses is laughing at God. "Would they had enough if their flocks and herds were all slaughtered? I mean, would we have enough if every fish in the sea were caught for them?" It's like, "God, you don't get it." And the Lord said to Moses, "Is the Lord's arm too short? You will now see whether or not what I say will come true for you." Most of all, we're dependent on God. God whose arm isn't too short for whatever we're doing. You know, that's where our strength comes from. That's where our power comes from. Number 5 is service. Service. We have a saying, or two sayings around Cornerstone. They're both posted on the walls. Do one thing and do it well. Do one thing and do it well. And the other one is whatever it takes. We say to people constantly, don't do 5 things. Don't do 20 things. Do one thing. Focus on it. Do it really well. Do it with intensity. I was leading a workshop over in Jackson, Michigan, and I was saying something like this, talking about recruiting help, how to recruit people. And some lady from a small church, she said, "That's fine for you." She says, "You're a big church. You got lots of people, but we're a small church. We all do so many things." She was really upset. And I said, "Why don't you just stop?" She goes, "What?" I said, "You don't have to do anything. You just have to have a worship service, and you probably ought to do something for the kids. Other than that, stop everything else." And she goes, "Can we do that?" her face was precious. "Can we do that?" And just then her pastor, who was sitting 4 row pews behind her, almost jumped over her pew. "No," he yelled. He was so threatened by that. I'm like, just stop it all. All the chicken dinners, all the committee meetings. You don't have to do all that stuff. You just have to have a worship service and do something with your children and start over again. I was trying to make a point, obviously. But, you know, just do one thing. Dallas Willard said that meaning of life is service to other people. That came home to me when a girl in our high school youth group who grew up in our church, grew up all parts of her life. She's probably heard the gospel 50,000 times in different ways in youth ministry and everything else. She said it was on a work camp experience. She told me this later. She said, I feel like I became a Christian on that. And I said, what are you talking about? You grew up here. You probably heard, you know, you had chances to become a Christian lots of other times. She said, no, but it was somehow I felt in my spirit, this is what it means to be a follower of Jesus when I was able to help some homeless person in whatever mission they were doing. There's something about serving that connects people with God. Ephesians says, God saved you by grace when you believed, and you can't take credit for this. It's a gift from God. Salvation is not a reward for good things you've done, so that none of us can boast about it. For we are God's masterpiece, and he has created us anew in Christ Jesus so we can do the good things he's planned for us to do. So at Cornerstone, we just find it a constant process of recruiting. We do something called Direct Connect about four times a year. And sometimes we set up booths in the hub area, which is our lobby area. We don't call it the narthex like Shane does here. Was that you joking about narthex? Yeah, last night. We call it the hub. Sometimes we just put it as an insert in the program, but there's always, here's what's happening right now. Here are the things we need help with right now. And we find a pretty good response that way. And when you preach on it at the same time, it helps even more. I just want to share this quick thing with you. This was of big interest to me. Some Penn State, one of the things we've worked on at Cornerstone is really trying to raise up lay leaders. You know, we don't have staff that do everything. We run pretty lean on purpose. We have two campuses now. Both are live preachers that grew up at Cornerstone. Not grew up from babyhood, but have been part of the Cornerstone congregation. Have some sense of call into ministry and have gone for their local pastor licenses now. We really believe in recovering the ministry of lay people. Penn State sociologists, two guys, did some research into Methodism. Their names are Roger Fink and Rodney Stark. Here's what they found. In 1776, there were 65 Methodist congregations in this country in 1776. 70 years later, in 1850, there were 13,302 congregations. In 1850, Methodists represented, they went from 2% of the population to 34% of the population. The largest Protestant denomination. When they asked these guys from their research, how did that happen? Their answer was, lay people. But here's what they concluded. The dramatic, meteoric rise of Methodists was short-lived. It's instructive to note that Methodists began to slump precisely at the time that amateur clergy were replaced by professionals who claimed Episcopal authority over their congregations. So revival happens when grassroots people start getting empowered and trained. And the two young guys that we have pastoring campus churches, have no pastoral experience. And both of those churches are on the grow. Started with 100 launch team, and both of them are almost 400 now. But I think recovering that power of the laity is super important. Okay, two, three minutes, we'll be done. Number six is generosity. And I just got to read you this just because it's fun, all right? Somebody sent me this. Several guys were sitting around the locker room of a golf club. The cellular phone was laying on a bench, and it began to ring. The man sitting beside it put on the speaker function. Everybody else in the room listened to the conversation. The man said, hello. The woman said, hi, honey, it's me. Are you at the club? The man said, yes. She said, I'm at the shops right now. I found this beautiful leather coat. It's only $2,000. Okay, if I buy it? The guy said, sure, go ahead if you like it that much. Woman said, And I stopped by the Lexus dealer. I saw that new model, the one we had talked about. I really like it. He said, how much is it? She said, $90,000. He said, okay, but for that price, I want you to be sure you get all the options you want. Woman said, great. Oh, one more thing. I was just talking to Janie, and our real estate agent, and she found that house. You know that one we looked at a year ago? It's back on the market. It's $980,000 for it. The man said, well, all right, make them an offer at $900,000, and if they won't take it, we can go the extra $80,000 if we need to. The woman said, okay, see you later. I love you so much. The man said, bye, I love you too. He hangs up the phone. All the men in the locker room are just staring at him, mouths wide open. He turns and says, anybody know whose phone this is? It's easy to be generous with somebody else's money, right? The Bible actually says a generous person will prosper, and he who refreshes others will be himself be refreshed. It also says the purpose of tithing is to teach you always to put God first in your life. I love it at Cornerstone that we can talk about generosity and tithing all year long. We don't save it for some stewardship campaign. We haven't done a stewardship campaign except for building purposes, capital funds, but not yearly stewardship. We stopped that about 5 years ago and more money came in. So why waste all the time? And that may not be everybody's culture, but that's our culture. I love to celebrate the win every time we take an offering. If it's time to receive an offering, I love to connect it with something. You know what? We had a middle school retreat this weekend. There were 75 kids there. Thanks for your generosity because you're making ministry happen in this church. Come on down. Celebrate a win every time. And people begin to think, it's a win to give. Stuff is happening in this church because we're giving. Last thing, number 7, is multiplication. God's math is never division. It's always multiplication. You have to reproduce yourself. I love it when people go, you know what, numbers aren't important. Numbers are super important. I mean, you read the book of Acts. Somebody's counting, right? There's 3,000 the first day, then there's 4,000, there's 5,000, 7,000 later on. Peter or somebody's in the crowd. You can just see him, 4,500. Oh, I lost count. He's got to start over again, Somebody's counting because numbers mean people. They mean souls. They are persons to be won for Jesus. And so they're super important. You have to just think about multiplying yourself. And we're trying to think about this on every single level. How do we get our children's department to think about replicating themselves, not so they're out of a job, so they can think about other things. Church leaders sometimes are afraid to replicate themselves. They think they're going to get out of a job. They're not going to get out of a job. There's other things to think about. There's bigger pictures to think about, but you're doing all the hands-on stuff. Our church changed dramatically at about 800 people attending when Doug Anderson came. Doug Anderson came for one day. Doug's an old friend. He did two things for us that day. Actually, one of them was about a week earlier, and that's why he came that day. He and I were sitting in Texas Stadium watching a Rangers game, and it was 125 degrees, and we went up under the shade because we were dying of heat. And I said, Doug, I think we need to build a new building. He said, can you afford it? I said, I don't know. He goes, give me a program. So on the back of a Texas Ranger program, he wrote down some numbers. He asked me questions about the budget and stuff. He goes, yep, you can afford it. That's how that building project started in the middle of a recession for $13,000 because of Doug Anderson at Texas Ranger Stadium on the back of a program going, yeah, you can do it. But he came up and he met with our key staff and we were about 800. I said, tell us how we can get past 1,000. And he looked around the room and he said, all of you were hired probably because you were good at what you do. You're good at children's ministry. You're good at youth ministry. You're good at outreach. You're good at... He said, you got to stop doing the ministry and turn about 95% of it over to other people. And you got to manage it. You got to manage the managers who manage the volunteers. There has to be another level of management in there. And it was a really interesting moment. Our youth person went, Yeah, that's right. And she went from a team of 7 to a team of 40 within a few months. I'm not kidding you. The children's person got it. The music person argued with Doug. And she was let go 18 months later. And her teams were shrinking while everybody else was growing. You got to reproduce yourself. And that's the whole motivation behind our multi-sites and anything else. I hope the conference never shuts down another church. Last year was a discouraging annual conference. I don't know if you guys had one or not, but the trustee report. At annual conference, the trustees come up there, and our head trustee went, "Well, we're shutting more churches down." That was the opening statement. Then we voted on like these 10 churches that were shutting down. His last statement was, "I hope next year there'll be fewer." I thought, "Whoa, let's celebrate that, you know." I would love to have some of that property. Whatever we do, it's got to be, maybe we can keep it alive. I want to see churches thrive. You know, I want to see places grow. I want to see God do some great things. Let me read you this last paragraph, and then it's break time. Only 6 minutes, 7 minutes over. Okay. I just came across this story. William Borden was born in 1904. He was born to a very wealthy family, and as a high schooler, he was able to travel around the world. Isn't that something in 1904? His family had so much money. They had so many plans for his development, his career, probably in law. They wanted him to go to either Harvard or Oxford. But during his travels, he felt the call of God to the Muslim world. Especially Muslims who lived in China. He came back. He said, "I want to be a missionary." They said, "There's not a chance. You're going to Yale or Princeton or one of these schools." So he did, but he never gave up his dream. He worked really, really hard in school. And when he graduated, much to the dismay of his parents, he said, "I'm not going into a law firm right now. I'm going to be a missionary first." And so he got on a boat, and he headed for China, and the boat stopped in Egypt so he could learn Arabic. And guess what? He contracted spinal meningitis, and he died in Egypt. He never got out of there. And a lot of people back home said, "What a waste of a life. He should have just stayed home and played it safe." But when his parents got his belongings back, they found his Bible, and on the back of his Bible were these words: "No reserves, no retreats, no regrets." That's what I want to say someday to God. Don't you? That you didn't hold anything back. You gave it all you had. You didn't have any regrets. No retreats, no going backwards. As Telly said this morning, we're going to be out there. We're going to be in the fight. Until God comes back again, until Jesus comes. Can I pray with you? God, thank you for these wonderful, unbelievable leaders that you've called in so many parts of the country. It's just so awesome to be with them. I just ask for your blessing upon their lives, their families, their churches, that you would anoint them and bless them and multiply them in so many different ways. That whatever they're praying about, whatever they're dreaming about, might come true. That you would give them the desires of their hearts. They'll make inroads they've never seen happen before, and miracles will start turning up. Thank you so much for every single one of them. Just walk with us as we work on together. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you, guys.